Okay. Okay, welcome everyone for yet another exciting episode of Let's Talk Podcast. Today's episode is really special for me because, okay, I think that is something which I'll still have some surprise. However, I would say that I haven't told the stories which I have done in previous episodes as well. So let's start with a story and see how many people can resonate with those stories as well. So this story is about the tale of dreams, struggles, and triumphs. Imagine arriving in the United States legally, in the land brimming with opportunities, your heart filled and full of American dreams. The story begins with young, ambitious individual who saw endless possibilities in every corner. He dreamed of starting a side business, seizing job opportunities as they arose, and exploring every avenues in the vibrant U.S. economy had to offer. And most importantly, he yearned for the freedom to make decisions without the looming uncertainty of having one day to leave everything behind and return to the home country. But soon he confronted with a harsh reality, the intricate web of visa requirements that bounds his aspirations. And visa constraints weren't just a barrier, they were formidable obstacles. As he delved deeper into the US immigration system, he learned about the grueling wait times for permanent residency, aka green card, especially for those or from those countries with extensive backlogs. Years of waiting, maybe decades, lays ahead of them, dampening his spirits and clouding the future of uncertainty. But then something changed. He was visiting a client, and his client's colleague, while having some regular chit-chat, mentioned an attorney they had seen on YouTube, an expert in an immigration law. He was skeptical, yet desperate. He hesitated, took a few weeks to even thought of reaching out. However, at the urging of his colleague in the subsequent visit, he decided to reach out. The attorney saw potential in his case, a strong one, but it needed hard work, commitment, and meticulous paperwork. Fast forward 2 years, he got an approval letter in the form of I-140 landed in his mailbox that marked the beginning of a few more approvals, and within 6 to 8 months, he received his green card in the email. And that card didn't signify, or I would say didn't just signify, a legal recognition, it transformed his life. And that person, ladies and gentlemen, is none other than me, your host, Saurabh Gupta. Yes, there are thousands of people like me in the same boat struggling with anxiety and uncertainty. However, not everyone is lucky to encounter with a person like the client's colleague who provides some suggestions at the face value. When people reached out to me later on, hardly 5 to 10% of the people knew the category through which I received my green card. But not now. Today, we will unwrap those opportunities to answer the key questions most of the skilled immigrants like me face all the time. But before that, I'm eternally grateful for a man who pushed towards excellence, pushed me towards excellence, who guided me through all the moments of frustrations when I was ready to give up. And today, I'm not only here to share my story, but also to shed lights on the paths of hundreds and thousands who are waiting for their prime years or living their prime years amidst anxiety and uncertainty. So it's my privilege to introduce you to the man who made it all possible, who helped me turn a dream into reality and never look back, attorney Sharif Silmi. Welcome to the show.
Wow. Thank you. That was really special and powerful, Saurabh. I cannot tell you how humbling it is to, you know, hear that. And it just reminds me of what this is all about. I think sometimes in the legal profession, we can get jaded. We can get, you know, even, dare I say, arrogant at times with our work. And it's nice to, you know, remember what it's all about.
The pleasure is all mine. I was waiting for this day to, I would say, tell the world my story. I was kind of procrastinating for a while, and that's why I reached out to let's have some conversation and share the story about how something can change from, and this is something which I have personally believe. There were a lot of people who were surprised to see that, oh, is it possible? Oh, you are not a Nobel laureate. You're not the Olympian. And those preconceived notions without having ample amount of research. So that being said, let's get to the discussion. So first of all, who are you? Where are you from? And what are your skill sets?
Okay. So I am Sharif Silmi. I was born in the East Bay Area, of you know, San Francisco Bay Area, and grew up in the U.S. my entire life. My parents, grandparents, and for 4,000 years, our people have lived in Palestine, which is now, as you know, experiencing great hardship. So we ask for everybody to pray for our ancestral homeland, and that its you know, burdens are removed, so that people can, you know, live peacefully, as they have for many thousands of years in that land. So, you know, and then I came out of a, you know, environment where while I was, I guess, you know, part of the fabric of American society, I was always sort of an other, if you will. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. the nature of things in a sense, like whether it's, you know, how you look or what your name is like, you know, you're, for example, you know, we just came out of the, as a Muslim, we just came out of the month of Ramadan and fasting. So I remember as a kid going through public schools, like, you know, there was a, like, why aren't you eating? Like, why are you not in the cafeteria with us? And, you know, those kinds of things. So you're just always, you're never quite fitting in to, you know, the, I guess, regular majority culture. So I've always had that sort of outsider perspective. And I eventually, you know, upon completing my undergraduate completing high school, I studied political science as an undergraduate and engaged in, you know, several different businesses. And we did really well, actually. I had a series of communication businesses. And then after about 5 years, I decided that actually more from an academic interest perspective, I decided to, and under the advice of one of my professors, who I remained in contact with, you know, I was explaining to him, like, look, we're doing really well, we're making great money. And he's just like, yeah, but I think you have something more. I think you should, you know, explore further, you know, learning. And I was talking to him about, like, you know, look, I'm not that inclined towards an MBA or doing like a master's. I would rather, you know, just continue what I'm doing, because I don't really think you need an MBA, because, you know, I was in business. So he's suggesting an MBA. And I said, you know, I don't feel like there's application for an MBA in the kind of business that I'm in. I think that we can, you know, sort of continue in other ways. And then he said, well, why don't you take your LSAT? And I said, what's an LSAT? And he said, it's a law school aptitude test. I said, okay, let me, that's interesting. I mean, I, like, from just growing up and sort of, you know, where, you know, the context of not really having any lawyers in our family, or, you know, it wasn't like, you know, you think of law school or, you know, the legal professional as a very, you know, quote unquote, a lead occupation. Like, wow, is that really something that could be for me? And I was extremely successful on the LSAT exam. And, you know, decided to go to law school, completed my studies, actually in 1 year less than the normal time period that is required. And, you know, started my profession as a lawyer. And I never really intended to go into immigration. I just sort of naturally kind of moved in that direction. And I think part of it is just that perspective of, like, while I'm, you know, quintessentially an American, I am one who understands the importance of, you know, the fabric of our society being enriched by, you know, further, you know, advancement of people coming into this country and adding value and adding their perspectives and their experiences. And I think that's what really makes America special in my mind is just the, you know, the importance of the cultures that are added into it, you know?
Yes.
Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd be miserable if I couldn't get, like, you know, like pho or something, you know, like Vietnamese soup, or, like, you know, some Indian food I love. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like, you know, what do we, if we, that's what I don't get about the anti-immigrant sentiment that sometimes exists. It's like, you know, like, do you really want that, like, you know, just only one aspect of your existence, you know, in terms of, you know, culture, like, you know, that we get to know one another by actually being or having our own cultures, you know, that's how we get to know each other. So it's, I think, pretty cool. So that's sort of like my background, where I come from and how I got into this sort of field.
Yeah, I think that's a great background, actually, that prompted me to ask a few questions around. So as you mentioned, and I think that was one of my questions, but you already answered a kind, as you mentioned that when you went to school, you have a different, those questions being asked, which you are trying to comprehend to answer, and those do not go with majority of the people. And you had that mindset, which eventually helps you to understand and empathize the people who are coming as an immigrant and what hardship they might be facing as well. And I think that helps you to pivot to this direction. And one of the things I like is, even though you are relatively comfortable in your previous life, in the businesses, you have a great mentor who guided you, right? To kind of, why don't you try this? And this is something which is very important. And I always seek people for some mentorship, and everyone should, because you don't know, there are people who by default lean on to help you and provide you unfiltered advice and see you within. Otherwise, maybe you would be still doing that business. But I guess, as we discussed before as well, when you hear some stories and when you're changing lives of people, that makes a big difference. And when you sleep in the night and having a smile on your face that, okay, one more case has been resolved successfully, and loads of thanks and best wishes to you and your family. That, I mean, definitely that would be a great feeling about it. So let's quickly get into some of the details who a lot of maybe viewers and listeners would be looking into. There are a lot of immigration attorneys and a lot of different classes as well. Now, why exactly we are talking on certain classes, and what was the class, if you recall, I was in, and any kind of details you can provide, because it's different from other sections of immigrant visa, and we can take it from there.
Yeah. So essentially, like, as part of that mindset, you know, in terms of how I came about and became an attorney, I guess you could say my approach was a bit different in a sense. Like, I was always a little bit unconventional in my thinking. And I think that sort of provided a basis, because I was at a national firm initially as an associate. And I was they were doing a huge amount of H-1B cases and a huge amount of like just H-1B transfers or just problems with H-1Bs and problems with, you know, different cases. And they had a large Indian population, Chinese population as clients. So I wasn't necessarily thinking along the lines of just like, you know, doing a green card sort of, you know, solutions. It was just like handling everything that would come in the door. And then they realized that I had sort of a talent with, frankly, client acquisition and being able to, you know, people just generally trusted me when I would explain solutions to them, because usually it's well-informed, you know, and it is not something that they were necessarily thinking about before. So that was giving us a lot of traction. And I, upon sort of analyzing the problem of the EB2 and EB3 backlog, and I think a lot of people understand what that means if they're in these immigration situations, but basically there's different categories of employment-based immigration, and based upon what category you lie within, you have a certain priority for actually being able to apply for a green card. So most people from India or China who are in either third category, which is basically a specialty occupation category, somebody with a bachelor's degree, and they're able to work, for example, in a technology related field or engineering, for example, they would be an EB3 category. And then once they have either 5 years of professional experience or an advanced degree, such as a master's degree or some kind of professional degree, then they're able to apply within the EB2 category, which theoretically is supposed to be faster than the EB3 category, but that's not always the case. And then there is also a very limited category of individuals who may apply within the EB1 category, which is reserved for three types of professionals: those who have extraordinary ability, those who are outstanding professors and researchers, and thirdly, international managers and executives, or multinational company managers and executives. So my perspective on this was just like, essentially, most of the individuals, and this is maybe like 10 years or 12 years ago at this, by now, most of the people who were facing these dilemmas were individuals who were working in either engineering, technology, you know, spaces. And for the most part, the solutions that were reserved in the EB1 category, such that they can get out of these EB2 and EB3 backlogs, were requiring one to have, or the thought was that they required one to have a PhD or, you know, publications and these like, you know, really academic credentials. So that was true mainly for EB1A, and which is the extraordinary ability, and EB1B, which is for outstanding researchers and professors. And then the only EB1 category, so the only way that anybody could really get out of this backlog would, and this is what they would do. And in fact, the one of the first, you know, EB1A cases that I took was a situation where an individual was on an L1A, and they also had an H1B. I'm sorry, an L1A, and they also had an I-140 approved in a, you know, lower category. And they were, I'm sorry, they had an H1B and an I-140 in a lower category, so they were in a backlog, and they decided to go to India, right, at the upon an agreement they made with their company to work for 1 year in India as a manager, right, of a functional manager, essentially, so that they could return to the United States on an L1A, work for that company for another 2 years, which was their agreement they made with the employer. And then at that time, you know, they would sponsor them under an EB1C. So this guy, you know, essentially goes through that process, interrupts his whole life, leaves his family, his family leaves all of their school and work activities and, You know, the kids are in soccer. They're just living like a normal suburban American life. They leave it all and they go to India and then, you know, work there for a year. It ends up taking them about 18 months to get back into the U.S., disrupt all of that, you know, life that they had, then serve another couple of years at this company. And then he goes to the, you know, boss and he says, okay, you know, you said you're going to file my EB1C. I was at that time, you know, he contacted me and said, you know, we're going to work on our EB1C. My company already agreed. What do I need? This is what I've done. He had consulted with me before he left and he, you know, consulted with me when he returned. And he goes to his company. We even prepared all of the documents, right? I mean, a stack this high of documentation. Perfect case for EB1C. Puts it on his boss's desk and says, you know, here's the documents, you know, go ahead and sign the I-140. And the boss says, why the hell would I do that? I was like, shock when he tells me. He says, why the hell would I do that? As soon as I sign this I-140, you're going to leave me and I'm going to have no benefit whatsoever. Wow. He was a, you know, consulting firm. So, you know, probably the billing, you know, the guy's making $20 an hour off his head and refuses to sign the I-140. Because he says, as soon as you sign it, I'm losing, you know, I'm going to lose you and I'm not willing to do that. So I'm going to keep you. So what is that then? If you think about it, strip away all of the facade of employment and, you know, your benefits and whatever you have. What is that? It's indentured servitude. It is American supported, and the law is essentially made in such a way that indentured servitude is allowed to exist in this country. And I said, I'm going to find a solution to that because this is BS, right? Yes. So absent Congress and a legislative solution, because I don't have the power of these multinational corporations that are lobbying Congress and making sure that people stay under their thumb. Because at the end of the day, the reason why there isn't progress with regard to immigration, in my view, has nothing to do with, you know, anything besides corporate lobbies and probably even attorney organization lobbies who don't want to see progress on this front. Right. And I'm strongly opposed and outspoken against these lobbyists. And I also think that the Indian groups who are lobbying for EB1A, for, you know, a solution to the backlog, have a terrible message. They're not like, you know, they're trying to like pit. So basically the Republicans are saying, yeah, the problem we have is, you know, we're bringing in unskilled immigration and, you know, you are the good guys, you Indian tech workers and engineers, you're the good guys. You're the guys who do everything legally. We like you. You know, and you, what you need to do is you need to point the finger at the bad guys who are coming into this country illegally. And the Indian community is saying, yeah, that's right. We're going to hop on that. And we're, and what happened? Two immigrant groups are now shooting at each other. And, rather than forming an alliance where both interests could be sought, they're pulling each other down. And there's no way there's going to be advancement without changes to, you know, folks who have been in this country for, you know, tens and 20 years, whether regardless of how they entered, there's going to be no there's going to be no comprehensive advancement without a solution for them. And there's going to be no advancement on the front for those who are in the backlog until their solution is done and vice versa. So the fact that we've been duped into shooting at each other or bringing each other down, that's actually maintained the status quo, because you can't get 60 votes in the Senate without doing something for those groups. You're never going to get 60 votes in the Senate without doing something for those groups. And what are the Indian pro whatever employment-based immigration and what do they call it? Merit-based immigration, you know, talking about or advocating for? they're advocating for the sort of policies that are going to impact the mainly South American, Central, and Mexican migrants, right? The lower skilled, if you will, or workers who are seeking to come to the U.S. to just basically survive, and are often running away not only from economic but from social and political violence, and then they're undermining what would otherwise be natural allies. It doesn't make sense, because legally we could have solutions that would be applicable to everyone, particularly if we look at something like, I have an easy solution. See, right now, if one is put into deportation, I'm sorry, I went off of EB1A. I know everybody wants to hear about EB1A.
Go ahead. Yeah, complete your thought.
A lot of my videos, I go into detail about all that. Please
go ahead.
But this is really important. If right now somebody is put into deportation proceedings, right? They're put into deportation proceedings and they've already been in the United States for 10 years. There's a process called cancellation of removal, meaning if you are placed into deportation proceedings, you've been given a notice to appear, and an immigration judge is assigned to your case, and you're appearing in a deportation case, one of the defenses to deportation is called cancellation of removal. The requirements for cancellation of removal are essentially that one be in the United States for 10 years. And once they're in the United States for 10 years, it's sort of like then there's a balance test. Do you have, U.S. citizen relatives, things of that sort. So if you think about the plight of the Indian community that are in this country, if they've been in the United States for 10 years, they all have children, usually one boy, one girl.
Yeah.
Two kids only. That's like the thing, right? Nobody's allowed
to have one. Yeah. Yes.
You can't have less and you can't have more. Two kids. Yeah. So they have, two kids and, probably U.S. citizen. Many of them are U.S. citizen, but even if not, there's other ways to go about this. But essentially, if you apply cancellation of removal to everyone, so cancellation of removal is today provided to individuals who appear in a immigration proceeding, right? And regardless of how they entered the United States, even if they cross the border without inspection, if they're given a notice to appear in deportation proceedings after 10 years of being in the United States, there's a balance test essentially that's provided. They haven't committed crimes. They are not part of any sort of, gangs or something like that. They have a clean record. There's like hardship to relatives and whatnot who are in the United States. They are granted cancellation of removal. Once you're granted cancellation of removal, you can adjust status to a green card, right? So I think an easy solution that would resolve all of this nonsense out there would be for Congress to pass an affirmative cancellation of removal statute that would just allow someone who's already been in the United States for a decade, has not committed a crime, and could demonstrate that his departure would lead to hardship. Boom, everybody would qualify for that, but they're not able to come together and talk about something like that, because rather than sit at a table together with groups that represent the, even undocumented migrants, the merit-based proponents or the so-called legal immigrants are pitted against what they characterize as illegal immigrants, which I have a huge problem with that kind of terminology. But what they characterize as illegal immigrants, or what I would characterize as undocumented migrants. So undocumented migrants and so-called legal immigrants, right, are never come together and exchange ideas, because they're basically been conned into thinking that they are enemies, and fighting for the same limited spots that this country provides individuals. And that is an enormous, enormous mistake and has to be rectified. And my experience dealing with people from, you know, India is that they are lovely, beautiful, generous people, and they would be able to do so much for the undocumented community. And the undocumented community, I think, has a longer history dealing with Congress and lobbying, and would be able to really benefit the Indian community in terms of their relationships in on Capitol Hill and throughout the government. So, I mean, I think that would be a huge, huge win. But I'm sorry to go way on this tangent.
No, no, I think that's a very insightful and interesting, I would say, a kind of
another out of the box solution
view. Yeah, you know, that's good. And anyone who is doing those kind of, I mean, part of those groups, I think that is a very good way of leading to that, like how exactly the strategies are working and how to make it sure that the immigrant immigration system is more structured and beneficial to all walks of the society here. So thanks for elaborating. Maybe I'll just re-listen again and try to see that people, and specifically try to appoint or pin the people who are working in this space. So that's great. So now with that story you mentioned, actually, that is one of the story which I have seen a lot of times. Some people go to India or their other South Asian countries predominantly, or some people try to go to Canada and then come back as well, what I'm seeing. But the unfortunate part is that there is no certainty in, you don't even know what tomorrow stores for you. So after 1 year, your manager changes, the conditions of the organization change. So there's a lot of at risk. And obviously you mentioned about the time, which we easily discount, which never comes back. The change and your family.
And the disruption, right? The disruption to life.
Exactly.
Yeah, so like with the case with this gentleman who, you know, the boss refused to give him that, you know, signature. We said, we looked at it and said, okay, well, you know, I mean, you're not like, you know, how you mentioned everybody thinks the EB1A, you have to be Einstein or something, but that's not the case. If you actually read the statute, what it talks about is, first of all, and then everybody thought you need to have publications, you need to be a scholar. But if you read the statute, there are five verticals that apply to EB1A, five verticals. One is you could be an athlete, you can be an artist, you can be an educator, you could be a scholar, or it says you could be a business-related contributor. And when I saw business-related contributor in the statute, I said, what the heck? Business-related contributor? Why aren't we thinking about EB1A for business-related contributors? Because, like, you know, we worked with you, obviously. If you think about the work that you did and what we sort of used as a narrative, it's really all about your business-related contributions. Because if I put your business-related contributions, or you know, an individual who's working in, let's say, a, you know, we talk about technology companies,
cybersecurity, and all
their sort of technology-related contributions, and maybe they developed an application or a feature or some kind of you know, methodology, right? Isn't that methodology or feature or application more interesting, more beneficial, more complex, more sophisticated than writing a journal article, right? So why is it that somebody who's sitting in a university writing a journal article considered to be more extraordinary than someone who is at a technology company or at a, you know, maybe engineering firm producing value and economic activity and creating, you know, solutions that are practical and impactful? It didn't make sense to me. And that's essentially what I started to argue, is that, look, dear adjudicators, there are enormously beneficial business-related contributions that exist here. And I happen to know very well how to make sure that they meet the regulatory requirements and the statute to assure that at the end of the day, the individual is going to be approved. And I think over a decade now, I mean, our numbers in terms of approval rate is just unbelievable. I mean, people, you know, I mean, like, if you look at all EB1A applications, all EB1A applications, the approval rate is about 53%. This is USCIS data. You can look it up. You know what's super interesting to me? They even have it by country. EB1A applications among Indian nationals, who I consider the most talented group of immigrants that come to this country, right? In EB1A applications among Indian national, guess what the approval rate is? Is it higher or lower?
Higher.
It's 43%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's 10% lower. 43%. Oh.
So basically, they're the difference, right? The way they are talented, but they cannot articulate it in the case.
I think they're being duped. I think that they're so desperate often at times that, you know, they go out and do things that don't make sense. Like if you have created a security protocol for, I don't know if I should name, I know where you worked. I don't want to name it, but let's say a different company. Let's say you create a security protocol for Google, right? And that's like an amazing thing, you know? Like you take a American typical middle-class family in Kansas and you say, hey, if your son grows up to develop a security protocol for Google, how would you feel about him? They'll say, I'll feel pretty damn good. That would be extraordinary, right? Well, it's like every, you know, Indian out there is creating like, you know, protocol for all of these major companies, you know, every Indian national is out there. And, but you know why they don't think it's extraordinary? Because they're all friends. So if you're the average of your five best friends, so if your five best friends are all doing this stuff, you just think it's normal. But like us, it's not normal. You know, it's it really truly is extraordinary. So, you know, I think being able to articulate that on their behalf is really important. And I think the other reason why you have a lower pass rate in terms of approval rate among Indian nationals is because there's an echo chamber. So like I could go into one of these forums and say, hey, I just got my EB1A approved. I went to, you know, Globee and Stevie and I did a bunch of, you know, reviews and then I published article in iJIRT and I, you know, did a media posting in through this PR company and they put an article in, you know, Guardian and I, you know, have those three criteria and I got my case approved. You guys should do it too. Here's a email and phone number of somebody who can help you get it done. And you call that person or you contact that person and they're going to be like, yeah, I'll get you a PR. I'll get you, you know, reviews and I'll get you whatever the other, you know, things are. And, you know, just send me, you know, $25,000 and all your problems are going to be solved for the rest of your life. Right. And they're so desperate that they do it. And then what happens? At least 60% of them or 70% of them or probably even higher, right, do not get approved. And then they, so they spend the $25,000 with the con artist. Then they spend another, you know, $10,000 on an immigration attorney or $12,000 on an immigration attorney. And then they get shocked because what's going to happen? You don't just get an RFE or a denial. You get a notice of intent to deny, which tells you that you met three criteria. However, your final merits determination is too weak. So we're not going to approve your case. They get shocked because they say, oh, I thought all I had to do is get three criteria approved. Why is this happening to me? This adjudicator must have been, you know, unfair to me, right? Or didn't, you know, didn't read the case. That's this BS. They read the case, okay? They appeal it and lose even more money. So it's a really a sad, sad situation. And I think I strive to just give them something that's authentic.
No, definitely. And I have seen that working with you because I recall some of my frustrations and we had some conversations. And just for all transparency, I think there was one time and I was like, okay, I'm no longer would like to work ahead, because I worked so hard, presented you some paperwork, and you said, no, this is not enough. I have to redo all those. And I recall that day there were no chat GPT. So then I have to articulate in a way that is satisfied to you and any other requirement. And it also gives a right proportion of what exactly, I mean, compelling argument. So I totally understand. And I think one of the thing is also like the more, once you get denied,
but when I that set they that have standard, some, but, sir,
yeah, that's standard, that right? Standard. So next approval is difficult then, right?
Yeah, that's how, I mean, that, well, the thing is that's how we know our cases are going to be approved, is because our internal standards are high enough that they exceed the statutory requirements. So they can't deny the case. When we know, I mean, some people, they're stubborn and those, like, you went and said, okay, you know what? Like, he drove me to the cliff. I could either jump off or I could fight my way out of the corner, right? And you fought your way out of the corner, and thank God you did it, because now, you know, you're approved. You have your green card. Life is, you know, much better than having to be on that, you know, sort of under control of those companies. So now, some people can't do it. Some people can't do it. And I understand. And I try to give them off ramp, or I try to give them approach to do it. But if that happens, you know, because to be frank with you, people who come to me, you know, they don't come to me with the easy cases. You know, people come to me with difficult cases. I mean, oftentimes, I mean, sometimes, you know, they are. But for the most part, we take the hardest cases and we have the best results. So the question is why? And the answer to the why is because we care. And even with AI and generated, so like whenever I ask for something these days, if I don't sort of tell them not to do it this way, the first thing that people do is they just generate a bunch of text through AI. And like, I don't know if you remember, but like we always talk about like, you know, prospective benefit to the United States.
Yes,
and how do you demonstrate prospective benefit to the United States? It's not about you or your profile. It's about the area of work that you're involved in. And we need to articulate how the area of work that you're involved in is beneficial to the US, right? So, I mean, if I say I work in developing, you know, security like features for cloud-based whatever, like, you know, database technology. And I want you to, you know, please explain how this is beneficial to the United States. And I put that into ChatGPT. It's going to give me a whole bunch of, you know, stuff. It's going to sound really good. And now I have two pages of information, right? If I send that as my introduction to the field, it's going to do zero for my case. It's going to do nothing. Like giving me that has zero value, because ultimately what the adjudicators must receive is evidence, is documentation. So
not like fluffy words.
You have a source of information.
I know. That's what we had a lot of back and forth. And I recall, I mean, and I did refer a couple of people and they were like, it's difficult. I said, that's why. No, I mean, if it would have been so easy, everyone would have done it. I mean, so that is one thing. So let's quickly get into some of the technical aspects of the thing. One of the things I would like to highlight as well, that you mentioned a few things about like averaging out. So I totally understand, because when I talked to a lot of folks, they were not even aware about EB1A. They thought that EB1 means EB1C, which is the manager. And up to a certain point, I was also having that notion that there is only one. But then when we try to research, we got in. Then the next hurdle is people only look into the Olympian and Nobel laureate. And as you mentioned about the business impact or generation, those things are totally sidelined because people do not want to research. They will go with the narrative which has been thrown at by their friends or community. And they just take it at the face value. And that's why when I got this through, people were so much amazed. They were like, you are not the Olympian. You're not a Nobel laureate. I said, okay, let's sit down and kind of discuss. So that being said, So EB1A is the category. So as a person who would like to start preparing, I know one of the things is mindset, which everyone has to start. Otherwise, there is no point. So would you like to elaborate that, okay, if someone reaches out to you or would like, I mean, the person who's right now viewing or listening, what are those top three steps they should be doing before even reach out to you, or what kind of assistance you can provide on a general level?
So, you know, look, at the end of the day, I think you have to be a class of professional who can qualify, right? And, you know, not everybody's going to be in that class. So we shouldn't give false hope that, you know, everybody absolutely can, you know, get EB1A. I wouldn't go that far. However, I would say that there are many tens of thousands of folks, even beyond that, who are in a class, meaning they are at a level, and particularly, I think, individual contributors, people who are directly developing products or methods or solutions or, you know, those sorts of things, they tend to do very well with EB1A. The first and most important advice I would give those folks is to document, document, document. Meaning, as you're going along in your career, you should be trying to document what it is that you're doing and what you're achieving and what you're, you know, whether, you know, have just a folder on your debt, you know, some kind of hard drive to say, like, even if it's like a meeting invite, right? Like, okay, I'm in a meeting invite with the C-suite, or I'm in a meeting invite with, you know, VP of whatever security or products or something. Like, those could be valuable in the future. So I would, because, you know, essentially sometimes we just need to prove events that have taken place. You know, you need documentation. At the end of the day, the reason why cases are successful is because of a robust record of evidence. And I firmly believe that you cannot make letters the cornerstone of a successful petition. You have to have existing documented evidence. So that would be the number one thing, is to document.
That is important, just to highlight before you proceed, because there is a wrong notion that you get a couple of letters and you're golden. So that's a good point. Go ahead.
Yeah. The second I would say is, so I guess I'm targeting my comments, tailoring my comments to, you know, mostly the, you know, the Indian community out there who are in this particular problem of the backlog. And, you know, I would say it's not necessarily an advantage to share everything that you're doing with everyone that you know. Some people will pull you down. They'll make you feel that because they're not able to do something, you're not able to do something. And that is a very dangerous thing to have around you. Certainly, there will be people that you will want to tap into and discuss aspects of things. Maybe they might be opportunity to network, or, you know, things of that sort that will benefit your case. But in my view, being overly consumed with chatter, whether it's through some of the forums that are out there, or even within your circle of acquaintances and friends and people who are in this situation, I don't necessarily think that, you know, if you have, maybe this is just something with my clients, but I feel like if you have a solid, and there's very talented and thoughtful and caring attorneys out there. Not everybody's, you know, like just selfish, you know, and only it for themselves. But if you have good representation and, you know, you're able to kind of like, and you're in a, because at the end of the day, like, one of the reasons why I think you're successful with your EB1A and many people are successful with their EB1A is you have this sort of entrepreneurial mindset already. And as a self-petition, right? It almost is sort of like an entrepreneurial endeavor. And anybody who knows who started, probably when you started this podcast, the same thing. Like if you sat there and said to all these, maybe people who are a little bit, because there's different personalities out there. You don't know what's in people's heart. And if you tell people, like, even when I went back to law school after being in business, like people who are, you know, around, or people like, hey, I'm going to go to law. What? Why are you going to go to law? Why are you going to do that? Why are they telling you not to do something that is beneficial? It's because they can't do it themselves. So people will bring you down. So sometimes I think it's best to keep things to yourself. As difficult as that is, keep it to yourself. So perfect. That would be the second thing. And the last thing is, as you're approaching your EB1A, is to be authentic. Be authentic. Don't be superficial. The adjudicators, and I have many friends who are former adjudicators and even some who are current adjudicators, what they say is, we could easily spot, particularly the EB1A adjudicators, we could easily spot the BS. You know, it's like when we see the same thing over and over and over and over, if we get 20 applications and 18 of them have the same exact evidence, whether it's for judging or membership, or, you know, I consider those supplementary categories, judging the work of others, professional membership, authorship, I consider those supplemental. So they tell me, when we see cases that are based on supplemental categories that are not central to the person's life undertaking, they're not going to work. We're just going to issue RFE, or we're going to deny. So you have to be authentic in a sense that your case should be, the foundation for your case should be based on what you've spent the most of your time doing. If you spent 90% of your time working in developing products, then your case should be about developing products. If you spend 90% of your time, you know, building or, you know, a bridge or a overpass design, then that's what you're building. Your case should be.
So quickly summarize these three points. Obviously, one is to document. And this is something is, and whatever you mentioned is not something which is very new. These are kind of a life lessons as well. Like whenever we talk about storytelling, one of the biggest, or I would say most famous, I forgot his name, storyteller mentioned that you have to document each and everything, what you are doing in a day, maybe some scribble through. And then when you try to come out and come back, you have so many stories around it. And that's why you mentioned first point is document. Second thing is I think one is to document, obviously have not, don't over publicize what you think, and have use your own wisdom, because they are people who have all the bad intentions. And the third one is be authentic. And now when you mention these things, I recall when I was going through, I literally spent months, my morning time is where I have a cleared mind, right? When I'm not cluttered with a lot of office work and other things related, household chores and so on and so forth. At that time, I always spent like 1 or 2 hours to write those things which we were discussing about it, and then try to point it down. And then again, we will discuss about whether that helps the cause or not. So I think these three are excellent. One of the thing I want to confirm is, because again, for the people who are listening, is does it require to have an active employment in the United States, or even do you want to be in the United States?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. I mean, there is a requirement that you continue to work in your field upon being approved. So you have to show a plan of engagement, you know, in the sort of short and long run. But at the moment of submitting the case, you do not have to be employed or employed in the U.S. or even present in the U.S. We have clients from all over the world. And I just want to make a clarification regarding the second point. It's not that I think people have bad intentions. Yeah. It's that I think that human nature is such that we have trouble seeing things that we are not capable of doing ourselves. So, you know, if you're speaking to people who, you know, are not maybe, I mean, as long as you're, if your circle are very elite, you know, level thought leader type, you know, folks, you know, like mastermind type thinkers, fine. But, you know, if that's not the case, then just keep things to yourself. Yeah. Yes. They're not going to help you.
Yes, exactly. That's a good point. So, and obviously it's a self-petition as well, right? If you kind of put in, provide some points on like, what is self-petition? Because most of the people think that employer files this, and now if it's not, employment is not required, then who can file, how it can file, and what does self-petition means?
Yeah, so there are two employment-based, you know, case types within under U.S. immigration law that are self-petitions, meaning you do not need an employer sponsor. One is what we're talking about, which is the EB1A, which is first category, extraordinary ability. It has other statutory requirements, but it does not require an employer. You can petition yourself, meaning you can directly submit an I-140 form without an employer, and you are required to include evidence to support your claim for the classification, right? So that's what's called a self-petition. And the other category of self-petition under the employment-based immigration system in the US is the national interest waiver, which is an EB2 level. So it's a much easier than an EB1A in terms of the requirements. But of course, if you're on a backlog, you know, it's not going to help you acquire a green card. Although I think the EB2 NIW is still very interesting for people on a backlog because it frees you of the need to have an employer sponsor your I-140. So you don't have to be on an H-1B with an employer-sponsored I-140 necessarily. You, if you have your own EB2 I-140 approved, it's personal to you and it remains with you regardless of, like, say you decide, hey, I'm going to go to Canada, I'm going to go to Singapore, I'm going to go back to India, I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there. That EB2 approval stays with you regardless of your employment situation. And whenever it does become current, you can come, you can use it to immigrate to the US. Or it could be a good kind of preliminary approach to set a priority date if you do not already have an I-140, because nowadays many employers don't want to submit an I-140 for an employer, for an employee. So you can kind of, you know, do your own I-140 with the EB2 national interest waiver, and the requirements are much less stringent than the EB1A.
Okay. And this is a very good point, because again, a lot of people aren't aware that employers is only one of the many ways to provide petition and apply for the permanent residency for green card. And I, as you mentioned, EB1A and the national interest waiver is the one. What about EB1B?
So EB1B is has to have a sponsor. So you have to have a private employer or university sponsor you, and it's reserved for research only professionals. So like if you are working even for a private employer as a researcher, then you may qualify for EB1B. You need to demonstrate that you are an internationally acclaimed outstanding researcher. There are criteria. You have to meet a minimum of only two rather than three as in the EB1A. However, the determination of internationally outstanding researcher can sometimes, depending on the adjudicator, be a bit difficult, you know, to meet. And then, so it's either researcher or tenure track professor.
Okay.
So it's reserved. It's intended for like academics. That's why I always thought it was so silly that people thought you needed to have a PhD to do EB1A, because like they have their own category, which is EB1B. So why do they need EB1A as well? You know, so I always thought that was funny.
Perfect. That's great. So so far we can got in that. Okay. EB1A, as a listener of your, I'm ready. I understood the mindset. I understood, okay, these are some of the things that we have to do. Okay, so now what is the expected financial cost, which I'm looking here? Again, ballpark, I'm not asking some, depends on your clients, there are different things, but like those government fees and all, is that something you would like to share? People have some ballpark numbers?
So the government fees have gone up a bit. I mean, I think when you were doing it, I don't remember how much it was, but it's gone up pretty significantly. I think particularly those who do premium processing. So premium processing is essentially a form that we submit with your case that allows you to have a response to your petition within 15 business days rather than waiting 8 or 9 mm-hmm. or 12 months. And that fee is, I believe, $2,800 and some change right now. And then the I-140 fee is about almost $800 these days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're looking close to $3,600, $3,500 just in government fees alone for your I-140 phase if you are to do premium processing. And then when your case is approved and you do the adjustment of status, it used to be that when you file adjustment of status, your I-485, which is the actual green card or adjustment of status application, your work permit application, which you use your work permit application temporarily while you're waiting for the green card to be issued, and your I-131, which is called advanced parole. So that's the ability to leave and reenter the United States while your green card application is pending. Those three used to be considered as a package. Mm-hmm. And it was about, $1,225 for the fees. Actually, with biometrics and everything, it was $1,410. So it was $1,410 for the fees for all three of those applications. Now what they've done is they said, okay, we're not going to make it a package. So if you're going to apply for a green card, you have to file for the I-485 adjustment of status. It has its own fee, which is about the same thing, about $1,400 or so. And then you have, if you want to apply for a I-765 employment authorization card while your green card is pending, that's another fee for that application. And then if you want to file for an I-131 advanced parole to exit and reenter the country while your application is green card application is pending, that's another fee. So that fee has sort of increased dramatically because what they've done is separate it out. Although if you are on an H-1B and you're in a stable situation, you don't necessarily need I-131 advanced parole, because even while your green card is pending, the I-131 would not be needed because the H-1B is a dual intent visa, meaning even if you've already intended to immigrate, you've already submitted your green card application, you could enter the United States with an H-1B, even though it's a non-immigrant visa, because it is considered dual intent, meaning you could enter as a non-immigrant, but still be intending to immigrate upon entry. Because that's usually a big deal. Your entry is one of the big deals that exists under immigration law, like how you entered. So for example, if somebody enters on a visitor visa, like a B-1, B-2 visa, and then 3 weeks later, they file for a green card based on marrying a U.S. citizen, the government's going to say, well, there's something wrong here because they entered as a non-immigrant. And it doesn't make sense that in 3 weeks, they come in with no intention to immigrate. And now all of a sudden, they've already met a spouse and have been married and are filing for an immigration case. So they consider that to be presumptively fraudulent. And then you'd have to overcome that. No, this isn't fraudulent. I went to Las Vegas and it was love at first sight. And I, went and, did a whatever Hollywood, kind of.
Vegas style marriage. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. to overcome the presumption of fraud.
Yeah.
So that's okay. Sort of the situation. In terms of legal fees, they range, but the demand is very high. I don't know what to tell you guys. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I'm a nice guy, but I stopped dealing with fees myself, because everybody in my office said, you're too damn nice. You need to be, you know, essentially charging what folks are, you know, willing to sort of pay you to do the important work that you do. And, you know, so I said, okay, well, I guess, you know, somebody else in our office could handle fee related matters, because it doesn't take the kind of, you know, legal talents that I like to spend my time.
And it makes sense as well, because a good quality comes with a price. And if you have a strong testimonials, then, and I'm pretty much inclined to that. If I like the quality, then, and that's why a lot of merchandise being sold, right? If you have a good quality, people are willing to pay the price for that. But that's a good point. So obviously you mentioned that ballpark $5,000 for approximately all the government fees, and obviously the legal fees as well, depends for them. They definitely would reach out to you. Now, the other question is about, we talk about this mindset, we talk about all the paperwork, the cost. What is the approximate timeline? I would say that in a best case scenario, for me, it took 2 years because of a lot of challenges, and that may be a story for some other time. But if you are working, what is the expected timeline you can expect from based on your overall experience? How much time people spend to reaching out to you to the point they file for I-140?
So I would say there's two tracks, essentially. Mm-hmm. There's a track for individuals who have, for the most part, the existing documented evidence that would support a claim. Mm-hmm. And in those scenarios, you're looking at probably 4 to 6 months. That's the fastest, I would say, that I've seen cases go. We've done some in 3, but I would say typically a case takes 4 to 6 months for one who doesn't have to build new things, If you're basing it on existing evidence of what you have already done and you're not building anything new, I would say 4 to 6 months. There are many, many cases that we take, which I think is a little bit unique for us, is where it's like, I could see that you have it, right? Like, I could see that you have it, but yeah, we're going to need to like build you up. You know, we're going to need to really work on documentation. We're really going to need to sort of like, you know, go to a place, dig down into the depths of our soul and produce something that, you know, is really going to like, you know, meet a very high standard. And, you know, based on what you already have, we're not quite there. You know, and those could take, you know, I would say, you know, up to a couple of years to develop if, you know, you have to really build that sort of track record. And the other thing is, sometimes you just got to let evidence sort of, you know, develop in a, its value has to develop. Because like, let's say, for example, you acquire, you know, an opportunity to review, to undertake some peer-to-peer review, and you've never done it before. You've never done it in your entire career, right? And we're really depending on that evidence to convince the adjudicator. And maybe you've done, now you say, look, I've done 3 reviews, right? But all of them are between April 1st and April 19th. And we're to submit your case on April 25th. And the entire 35 years of your career, you've never done a review. And now in 2 weeks, you've done 3. Do you really think the adjudicator is going to buy that? It needs to be spread out a little bit over time. It needs to be a little bit organic and natural. So yes, it depends on where they stand and
where they get.
Yeah.
Actually, that brings me a very good point, because how many people in the world spend time about learning about themselves? I mean, for me, as I mentioned, it took me 2 years to understand the value of the work, what I was doing, and put it in writing with your guidance. Not only that, I mean, I always mention to the people is worst case, what would happen? You would be a different human being altogether. Even, God forbid, if EB1A didn't go through, you have so much of material about yourself because you're prepared. You didn't know that there's a human being existed within yourself, because you're, most of the human being are like getting to a reactive phase of their life. So maybe a bit of philosophical side, but I totally understand that this whole process can take from 4 to 6 months to a couple of years. I am living example. Took me around 2 years, but that totally transformed me. And I was so confident because that spills through other aspects of your life. I was much more confident because now I learned much more about myself.
Yeah, that, you know, I get that a lot, actually. I mean, people tell me, like, you know, the way that we did it, because it is organic, because it is natural, because it is based on what people spend at least 90% of their time doing, what ends up happening is they're just like, you created this sort of narrative of my entire life's work that's not only helped me to get this immigration benefit, but now, like, when I go and talk to either, you know, employers and sometimes investors or sometimes partners, like, I have this sort of like documented story of myself that I can present that really like shows a tremendous amount of value to people. And, you know, like it really, I think, you know, has benefited people in ways that they wouldn't have anticipated.
Of course, of course. So I think we are towards the end of our conversation. There are a lot of things anyways to share, but I think you have covered a lot of aspects of what are the requirements and obviously providing a lot of contextual information before we get started. So the last question would be, if people have gone and listened through this, I think more than an hour. Wow. Okay. So hour and a half, close to hour.
I'm flying and having fun.
Conversation, and they would like to pursue the next step and maybe reach out to you as well. What are some of the mediums they can reach out?
So you could please, you know, you could check out our website, you know, silmilaw.com, S-I-L-M-I law, L-A-W.com. We also have a LinkedIn presence and, you know, Instagram, all, you know, whatever social media. But I would say that the best thing that you could possibly do, even if you're doing your case with another attorney or you don't necessarily think that you even have a case, you just want to be curious and find out, like, you know, there's so many people I can tell you who don't realize what they have. You know, we can analyze it. We can look into your story and see whether, you know, we can sort of polish off those gems on your behalf. And I would say the best thing that you could possibly do is to just, you know, book a consultation, right? Like, I will give you a lot of value in a consultation. I mean, I'm not going to like hold anything back.
Definitely. That being said, Attorney Sharif, thank you so much for providing the time. And just for this conversation, it gave me additional dose of how important it is about learning yourself, storytelling, and keep on the path of what we always should be doing and make our life fulfilling. So thank you so much for making my life to this level that we are having some conversation. And I wish you all the best for your future endeavor. May a lot of people get success through you and make your life and your family's life fulfilling as well.
Thank you. I really appreciate you. And I'm most of all, I'm really proud of you. I'm genuinely really proud of you and what you're doing and what you've achieved and what you're continuing to achieve and the good intentions that you have for people. I think that's great. And I hope we stay in touch, and, you know, we I'm sure we will. And I'll keep watching you and following you on LinkedIn and elsewhere, and you know, keep up the good work.
Sure, definitely.